20 minutes ago. Was it that long?
Hi, my name is Ken. I'm an alcoholic.
Can you hear downstairs? You just missed some real important announcements. I guess you know about the fire drill tonight at midnight, but that's already been covered. No sense going over it.
Well, I'm really glad to be here. This is some outfit. You're sitting here, and people are just coming and going, you know, and it's like, this is like a hanging, you know, you just figure, you know. Well, I did all I could for the boy. That's all I could do, you know. Said a prayer for him, you know. And now he's kind of on his own, you know. But this is good stuff. I mean, this is, I've had an interesting deal for me. I learn a lot when I come to these things. You know, I want to thank Jay and Charlie and all the folks on the committee for inviting me here, and particularly for Stan and his wife and the folks picking me up at the airport because we were late getting in. And it's just amazing. It's just amazing. I learned a lot here. I was sitting at dinner tonight with Shirley and Charles, and that's the first time in there, and a bunch of folks that they sponsor, and first time I ever knew that that hush puppies made you impotent. Now, I immediately put mine down, you know, like, and then they told me that oysters offset that. You know, like oysters made you potent. So I went back, got some seconds. You know, and I thought, I didn't know that. I've been here on this planet a while. I just didn't pick up this critical information. It's just amazing how they just have this right there at their disposal like that, you know. So now in my mind, I'm thinking there must be, if you really like hush puppies, you know, being a typical alcoholic, I'm thinking there must be a balance of oysters to hush puppies that you can eat what you want and still want, you know? You know? So I mean, that's the way my mind goes, you know, like, you know. I don't know, you guys do that stuff too? Yeah. I wonder things like I have a thing in the bottom of my refrigerator, it's called a crisper. It should be called a rotter. You know, like I don't know why I put things in there. I'm going to throw them out. They're going to be bad. I don't know why. I just don't take them and throw them in the trash. It's like, and get rid of it. But I always go for this crisper ruse. You know, like, I think I'll try that crisper one more time. See what happens, you know? An abbreviation. How come it's such a long word? You know, those are the kind of things you got to really focus on in life. You know, when I was growing up, I used to think, if my knees bent the other way, what would chairs look like? You know, like, you know. And so I was like in I was doing like a pre-graduate work for AA, you know, like I was getting ready to come here, you know. And, you know, I was watching the other night, there was the movie Classic Station had on the Wizard of Oz. And, you know, at the end of The Wizard of Oz, I had missed this. I had seen Wizard of Oz many times, but it just hit me this time that Judy Garland and Toto and the three guys there, they were at the city, and they went to see the wizard. And the wizard was behind the curtain, and he was making noises and pretending to do what he did, you know, what he do. And he didn't do very much. And anyway, he was back there making this noise, and Toto, the little dog, came and pulled open the curtain. And Judy Garland saw the wizard and she said, "You're a very bad man." And he said, "No, I'm a very good man. I'm just a really bad wizard, you know?" And that's the way my life is, you know? Like, I feel like I was a pretty good guy. I just wasn't good at what I was doing, you know? And it seemed like I was always doing other stuff. And it had to do with this mind stuff, you know, in this owner's manual that they give you here in AA. And if you don't have one, you should get one and just read the words. Don't make up a lot of stuff because I'm sponsoring a psychiatrist now. He reads stuff and nobody even intended, you know, like, you know, he's a, I mean, here's a guy got so many degrees, he has trouble opening the door, you know. It's like, is this the right door? Is this the one I should be at? Is it, you know? And he's now setting up the hall for one of our meetings, and we have a guy who, you know, got through school totally unscarred by education, and he got about a fourth grade education, and he's trying to train the psychiatrist. And he calls me, and his conversations go something like this. Ken, I'm really working with the guy, you know, like, but you tell him the same thing every week. You know, he wants to know, why do we put this many things of coffee in the coffee pot? I said, because that's the way they tell me. He said, he always has the same questions. Then the guy calls me, who's a psychiatrist, and says, this is terrible. I have a guy with a fourth grade education telling me what to do. I said, yeah, but we trust him. That's why he has the keys. You know, when we trust you, we'll give you the keys, and you'll get to make the coffee all on your own. You can talk to yourself, you know. You can do whatever you need to do. But, you know, and that's the way it is in this program. You know, so much goes on up here. You know, this book says, you know, if the alcoholic doesn't drink, he tends to act much like other men. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic rests in his mind, rather than in his body. You know, you talk to any Al-Anon, she'll tell you that, you know. Yeah, they know that stuff right away, you know. You take alcohol away from the alcoholic, you're still left with that ick, you know. You've got that ick, you know. Yeah, he's still here, the ick, you know. You know. And I love the jokes. I love the jokes that Al-Anons make up. We have a little gal in our area. She's so petite and she's so feminine. It looks like butter wouldn't melt in her mouth. And she tells me the best Al-Anon jokes, you know. Like she says, you know what you call an alcoholic with half a brain? I said, no. She's gifted. And you say, I mean, that, is that great or what? You know, that's what they are. Like, yeah. Like, you know? And when we go to meetings, we get to see this because we're not really laughing at anybody's problems at this meetings. We're laughing at their solutions, you know. You know, they scratch stuff that don't itch, you know. You know, they got these kind of minds. They go to a wedding, they want to be the bride. You know, they go to the funeral, they want to be the corpse, you know. And they want to do it humbly. Like, you know, don't notice me. You know? And that's just the way they are. And this mind thing goes on and on and on. You know, and people say the dumbest questions. You know, like they have the dumbest questions. And they say such interesting things. I took a guy 2 years ago. That's what was bowling. I saw those trophies. I took a guy to get bowling trophies, and we went into the place, and he looked around, and he says, wow, is this guy good? You know, just relax, Sparky. You know, pace yourself. You got the whole day, you know, like a... You know, and that's what I love to work with. I love to work with those newcomers and those real alcoholics who are just like me because, you know, we're trying to escape a reality we're not in. You know, that's we're busy trying to get out. We're not even there, you know, like, yeah, I'm there. No, I missed it again. That went by me, you know. And it's so much fun, you know. I love to watch newcomers because you just watch them, you know. And it's like the hamster's dead, but the wheel is still turning, you know. Like, whoo. Woo! And the guy looks at you, and they always have that look like they're just visiting. You know? It's like, it's the opposite of deja vu. It's more like vuja de, you know? I was here, but I wasn't here, but now I think I'm here again, you know? Do you recognize me? You know? Like, and that's the kind of looks they have. And that's why when you come in here, you know, and they give you this book, they give you the old timers, hopefully get you into this book right away and get you started on the steps. Because, you know, you have no idea what's going on. You know, you really don't. And it's a case of the way people think. You know, that's really what this deal is about. It's not about what's going on. It's what people think is going on. You know, it's more about like a perceptional overlay of a non-reality fantasy surrounded by a delusion wrapped inside an enigma, you know. And it's And it's like, yeah, I'll get to it in a minute, you know. You know, and nobody really knows, and you're just watching the wheel go, you know, just there goes again, you know, God bless them, you know. And you just watch their head sometimes. You can just tell, you know, those synapses aren't making it all the way over, like, you know, like, well, that was a half stroke, you know, that was a, and that's just the way it goes on, and it goes on like that all the time. And it's this perceptional thing, you know. It's like the two kids in the hospital, the 2 5-year-olds, and the 1 5-year-old says, I'm in here to have my appendix out. What are you in here for? And the other 5-year-old says, well, I'm in here to be circumcised. The first 5-year-old says, wow. He said, they did that to me when I was first born, and I didn't walk for a year. You know? You know, like. you know? And that's the way they are, you know. That's just the way they are. It's all this perceptional stuff. And what you guys do, that's the only reason I come and do this, is because I love to hear people laugh. I love to watch them laugh, and I love to hear them laugh. Because I know something about laughter that most people don't know, and that is you cannot laugh and think at the same time. It's an impossibility. So when you're laughing, you're getting a respite from your favorite subject, which is you, you know. It's like, where did I go? Oh, okay. I'm back, you know. You know? And that's why it's, and it produces these endorphins now. They tell you if you laugh a lot, it produces these endorphins, which makes you very, very healthy, you know. So you want to get those endorphins going, and you want to laugh a lot. And just look at it this way, you know. If you're not laughing, everybody else is laughing at you. So, you know, this is like a cosmic joke. You might as well get in on the laughter because, you know, you're going to miss out otherwise. You know, and the idea is that, you know, the book talks about that. It says, you know, God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. You know, he doesn't make our misery. We make our own misery. And talking to alcoholics, you know how long they're sober just by the way they talk. It's almost like you can tell, you know, it's like it gets down to, if they're talking 30 years ago, they're probably fairly new, you know. Either that or they just don't go to a lot of meetings, you know. But the bottom line is, you know, I know this, I've come to this realization, and this works for me, and that is, we can only be in the now. That's all there is the now. There is no past, there is no future. The past was a now that's already gone by. The future is a now that hasn't gotten here yet. When you look at the future, you're looking from the now. When you look at the past, you're looking from the now. So why not live in the now? You know, hang out here for a while. Guy said, I got a lot of resentment. Aha, uh-huh. I know what that is. It's too much past in your now. I got a lot of fear. Oh, I know what that is. That's too much future in your now. What you need to start to do is have industrial amounts of now in your now. Cut down on that stuff. You know, start to really live in the now. And what you'll find out, I don't care who you are, I don't care what your life situation is, if you are living in the now, you don't have a problem. Every problem you have is looking back or looking ahead. And I found out something about this mind that always caused me a problem. It can't live in the now. It has no capacity to live in the now. It can only live in the past or the future. So all I got to do to take control of it is keep it in the now. And I say, oh, this stuff really works. And then I read in this book, the owner's manual, it says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him Thursday? You know? No. Find him now, you know? Because if you find him now, he lives in the now. That's why there's no problems in the now. You know, he is the great reality living in the now. And the rest of this stuff, you're running around chasing your tail. You know, you're kind of just a lot of activity. You know, but you're not going anywhere. You know, it's like changing deck chairs on the Titanic. You know, who cares where you sit? You know, the whole thing's going down. You know, like, you know, I'm on the promenade. You know? No, you be in the water. And it's the deal is, and alcoholics just think we know stuff we don't know. We never knew it, but we never let that bother us, you know? And we'll share with you what we don't know until you look confused, and then we'll go with your side because it sounds more realistic, you know? We call that surrender, you know? And the whole idea is we just don't know what's going on. But the idea is nobody wants to tell anybody. Hey, I don't have a clue, you know? And we always want to make up a story, and it's always a great story. You know, and it's like we think we know what we don't know. I remember the story they used to tell of this Catholic guy was crossing the street, and boom, he gets hit by a bus. And he's laying down there, and he's asking for a priest. He's asking for a priest. And the policeman looks around. He's holding him by the head, and he says, is there any priest in the crowd? And there isn't. But out steps this alcoholic. And he says, I lived behind the Catholic church my whole life. I know all the prayers. I'm not a Catholic, but I know all the prayers. He says, well, you know, you're better than nobody. Say a prayer. So the alcoholic leans over the dying man, grabs him in his arms, and whispers in his ear, be one.
I, 14. You know? Goodbye. You know? Well, I did my best, you know. That's it.
And that's the way it goes on. And then when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, fortunately, I got in with guys who just did this book. You know, they didn't do 10 other things. You know, they didn't go to sex without partners. And, you know, they didn't do all this stuff. They focused on this.
I don't want to say too much. It's mixed company.
But they said, this is the book. You know, this is the book. And you know, I used to just listen to the old timers talk, and they would always talk about spiritual things. We got to have a spiritual answer, you know. And I always liked that idea. And then I looked at the word spiritual, and I too got through school totally unscarred by education, you know. That's just the way it was. There was education there. I always tried to tiptoe over here, you know, like a daydream, delusion. I was good at delusion. That was my strong suit, you know. And I don't know if you guys know this, but about 10 years ago, a new word snuck into AA. Denial. I don't know where it came from. I have some suspicion. The people now say, I'm in denial. That's not what the book says. The book says, you're in delusion. Now, there's nothing wrong with the word denial. It's a nice word. It's just not an alcoholic word. If you get a dictionary and look up denial, it says, someone who knows the truth and refuses to tell it. You look up the word delusion. It says psychotic thought. Where the individual involved has no concept of reality. Now, that's us, you know. Hell, denial in my group is spiritual growth, you know. Spiritual growth over here, you know. You know, and I don't know about you guys, but I needed leadership right from the time I was born. I needed a sponsor, like when I was in kindergarten, you know. And I needed someone to call me on the phone and say, Ken, eat the cookies, take the nap, you know. And I'd be okay. And my deal was I never knew what I was going to do even while I was doing it. I'd be in the middle of doing it and then think, why did I start this, you know. Or I'd come out somewhere, you know, and I'd be cross-examining me, or I'd be testifying against myself, and, you know, so now when I go out, you know, like I kind of Mirandize myself, you know. Anything you say can and will be held against you, you know, it's all on tape, you know. And the bottom line is that when I was out there, I don't know about you guys, but I was like a cat on the freeway, you know. I had a lot of moves, but they were all out of fear. You know, like, I wasn't making anything graceful. You know, like, oh, that bumper almost got me. You know, like, yeah. You know, and I used to get along so well with animals. Not at first in my life, but later on. I remember a bunch of guys I played poker with one night, they just got tired of me, and they didn't want to do anything with me, but so they threw me down a couple of flights of stairs. They just tossed me out of this room, and I fell like two flights of stairs. Actually, I just cleared the stairs and landed on this landing. And there was a cat there. And I kind of landed like this. And I looked at the cat. I know this didn't happen today, but at the time I thought he looked at me and said, "Hey, nice landing." You know? You know? You know? I thought we were on the same page, you know? Want to see me do it again? You know? You know? But that's the way I was, you know, and I don't know about you guys, but that's the way my whole life was. Now, I came from a family where we were divided into two groups, either you're in AA or you needed it. You know, like, you know, I'm the youngest of seven, and like, my mom was the only one who didn't drink, and I've had brothers and sisters die behind this thing, so I understand the seriousness of it. But the bottom line is, you know, my mom used to say, the only time I ever heard you say no to a drink is when you misunderstood the question, you know, like, you know. She used to look at beer cans and say, "What are they putting here that makes you act so stupid?" You know, you know, like, and like, and she was on my side. You know, she was really a good support system for me because she loved me. There was never any doubt about my mom loving me. She just couldn't relate to me. You know, I couldn't relate to me. You know, I used to sometimes just like wonder, is anybody else experiencing the stuff that's going on in my head, or am I just kind of hanging out here by myself? You know, these strobe lights would go off and somebody said, "What happened?" "Nothing." You know? You know? And I never used drugs. You know, I never used drugs. I have nothing against people who did. I'm not saying it from that standpoint, but I never used drugs. I never smoked a marijuana. I never took a pill. I never did any of that stuff that was out there. I grew up in Brooklyn, and I lived in a neighborhood that was run by a bunch of guys who talked kind of funny. And if you used drugs the first time, they would open a car door and slam it on your hand. I said, "We don't do it on the neighborhood, okay?" And then if you did it again, we always figured you moved to Jersey because, you know, you were gone. You know, nobody, you know. What happened to Tony? I think he moved to Jersey. You know what I mean? You know, he's gone. You'd just be gone. Like, we never saw you again. So not too many people used drugs and stayed there. They all kind of used them and moved to Jersey. And that's just the way it was. And when I got here with my sponsor was great because he said, you know, we're going to go through these steps. And what I've come to find out is that I had to die to the person I was. The person I was couldn't stop drinking. I had created a counterfeit Ken, and I couldn't pass it anymore. People saw it too clearly. It had reached the point where I couldn't pass off this counterfeit Ken. And so I had to die on purpose. And I died on purpose by taking the steps. If you're working with anybody who's suicidal and they really want to get out because the pain of life is too overwhelming, help them. Take the steps. That's the best way to kill somebody. And this way you get the secondary reward because you get to hang out and see what really goes on. You know, you don't have to go with it. It doesn't have to be the final solution. And the nice part about me is that, you know, I know that steps 1 through 3 for me helped me to clear up. And then 4 through 9, you know, they helped me to clean up. And then 10 through 12 helped me to grow up. You know, at some point you have to just say, I'm responsible for what I did and what I didn't do. This is me. My mom had nothing to do with it. My neighborhood I grew up with had nothing to do with it. You know, it was a nice neighborhood. It was the safest neighborhood in the city. You could leave a radio on the stoop and it'd be there the next day. If anybody took it, they wouldn't be there. You know? You know? We used to have sayings in Brooklyn in that section because they said, "Well, you know, how far is it to the subway?" We said, "We don't know. No one's ever made it." You know what I mean? You know? You know? Or, "He fell asleep in the trunk of a car. He deserved to be shot." You know what I mean? You know, you know, those were the kind of guys we hung out with, you know? I remember saying to a guy one time, his name just happened to be Tony. Everybody in Brooklyn's name started with A. A Tony, A Phil, A Joey, you know? And I said, is there a God? And he said, why do you ask this question? This was when I was running numbers. Shh, we're not supposed to do that. And I said, do you think there's a God, Tony? He says, "Ken, of course there's a God." I said, "How do you know? How?" And this is a guy who's making a living, not doing what you're supposed to be doing, and moving people to Jersey on a fairly regular basis. And I said, "How can you say that with that much confidence that there is?" He says, "Do we ever lose?" I said, "You mean when we're running book?" He says, "Yeah, do we ever lose?" I said, "No." He said, "You think God's going to make a game where he loses?" God is in hot, hot pursuit of all of us, and eventually he catches everybody. You know, it looks like you're getting away. It's just not happening. You know, you're running in mud. You're just making a lot of mess, but you're not going anywhere. You know, like, you're just kind of hanging out. And the nice thing about it is you get to hang out here in AA. One of the things I became painfully aware of in the last few years of my life is that in this lifetime, I've lived many lifetimes. And what's happened is, in each lifetime, I had exactly what I needed to move forward to that lifetime. And what I didn't need was just went away. But I always had what I needed. And in the now, I always have what I need. It's not like I got to go looking for it. I always, always have it. And the nice thing about that is the fact is that after a while, in this book, you know, it tells me things that are very, very functional, like lack of power. That's my dilemma. What does that mean? It means you can't do it. You know, I won't complicate that. It means you can't do it. And then it says, there is one who has all power. Okay. So I don't have the power, and there's one who has all the power. Gotcha. Okay, so far we're doing good. Now, where do I find him? Deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God, the great reality. The great reality is within. Good. I think I'll move to India. I have people in my area moving all over the joint. Where are you looking for God? I'm going to go to Thailand. I'm going to go to Tibet. I'm going to India. But what about this fundamental idea? Yeah, I'll check into it when I get back, you know? People have the idea that somehow God is opposed to indoor plumbing. You know, like, you can actually stay here and find God, you know? You don't have to catch hepatitis to find God. You can, you know, you can kind of find him right where you're at. And say, fundamentally, deep down inside of us, and people go, okay, maybe he's over there, you know? I think I see him, you know? And it's like, let's go slow, because some of this stuff might be overwhelming. And you got to do this stuff on a daily basis. You know, this psychiatrist guy, I'm really getting to like him. He's very sick. You know, God love him. And he gets paid big bucks to help other people. But he said to me, the book is so very vague. It's so very, very vague, you know. I said, well, what do you mean by vague? Like vague or vague? And he said, vague. Which now I knew what he was talking about. So I said, well, let's go look at this step here. We'll look at the 11th step, because that's a good step, because it's very vague. Let's start with that. When we retire at night, doctor, when do you think that would be? Like you brushing your teeth and turning out the light and setting the alarm for tomorrow? That may be retiring at night. And maybe it tells you exactly what to do. We constructively review the day. Not destructively, constructively. Okay, that might throw you off because retiring is vague. Okay, let's go to the next part here. It says, upon awakening. And what do you think that is, doctor? Like, in the morning, like, when you open your eyes and you look around and say, oh, I think I'm upon awakening. You know? How vague is that? During the day, when agitated, or when faced with indecision, how vague is that? You know? I said, let's read this next line here, because this line applies to you. It says that we have to turn our will and our life over to God. That's what we have to do. And so we have to do that, and the book says, many times during the day you have to say, thy will be done. Many times. Many times. Many times. Thank you. They're a little early. They were supposed to come in about 2 more minutes. But that's organization when you're working with big shots. I know. But the deal is, it's many times during the day. And, you know, and most people will say to me things like, I get up in the morning and I'll get on my knees and I'll do the third step and then I go off and I run into some problems. many times. Many, 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 many times during the day. This is not a one-shot deal. This is not about a get-it-done-to-go-on-to-something-else deal. This now is not a means to get to the next place. This now is this now. It's the totality of who we are, where we are, doing what we do. And sooner or later, if you're lucky, very lucky, you come to the idea that this mind that you're carrying around is not who you are. Who you are is much bigger than that. That's just somebody you pretend to be. That's the person you've made up. And that's the person you get rid of when you take these steps. Every step is based on surrender. Surrendering to the fact that I cannot pretend anymore. I have to get rid of this stuff. And in surrendering to it, it's not defeatism. It's not resignation. It's not giving up. It's just accepting reality. Being in reality is like being in reality. And that's why the book calls it the great reality. Deep down inside us is the great reality. You know, that's what really is. And everything else is make-believe. You know, we just make it up. And it's all about thinking. You hear people say, well, you know, that's beginning to make a lot of sense. Let me go home and think about it. You'll never get to God thinking. It just won't happen. What will happen is you've got to make this quantum leap that's kind of like, eep, and you're over there. And it's not about getting to them through thinking. If it is, then people would just read books and that would be the end of it. You know, read a few books, do a few good works, and bye-bye, you're okay. You know? But that's not the way it works. This great reality thing is about the great reality. And it's about getting past this thinking thing. And we all have our own perception of what we think is happening. And that's why when we look at something, we don't see it. The mind sees it, and what it does is it labels all this stuff. And that's why the book says in every step, we have to surrender to the fact that this power greater than ourselves will bail us out. You know, and it's funny. After a while, you realize that everybody's coming at it from a different point. Did you ever walk into a conversation where you heard what the first two people said and the other people in the conversation didn't, and they're all talking about something different, and they really think they're addressing something? You know, I kind of like those conversations because it reminds me of the fact that that's the way it goes on a lot of times. You know, just make believe. It's kind of like this thinking thing is kind of like the school teacher who had this boy, and he was very slow in math, she thought. So she kept him after school to tutor him. And she said to him, okay, John, she said, if there are 12 birds sitting on the fence and I shoot 5 of them, how many are left? And he said, none. She said, let's go again. That one might have been too fast for you. There are 12 birds on the fence, and I shoot 5. How many are left? He said, none. She says, what do you mean, none? He said, if you shot 5 birds, the rest of them would all fly away. And she looked at him. She said, you know, your math is terrible, but I really like the way you think, you know? And he said, do you mind if I ask you a question? And she said, no. And he said, if there are 3 women coming down the street and they all have ice cream cones, one's licking it, one's biting it, one's sucking it, which one is the married one? Teacher thought for a minute and said, the one sucking it, I guess. And he said, no, the one with the wedding ring, but I sure like the way you think, you know? Like, and you see, we find that humorous because it is humorous. You know, it's all about what we think, you know. People come to meetings, you know, and you know, I don't know about, some people say, well, you should tell more about when you were a child growing up, and you should talk about when you were drinking. And look, the things I remember about drinking most clearly never happened. You know, those things that are most clear in my mind, they didn't even happen, you know. I was wandering around bumping into stuff, you know. I remember one time coming out of a blackout and the judge was saying, how do you plead? And I said, I'm supposed to be in a football game. You know, like, What do you mean? Like, you know, I was on the subway. I, you know, was heading to the game with my brother, and we had a beer, you know, that infamous, you know. That one beer, that infamous one beer, you know. And I, some people say, well, you know, more about that. Well, I could tell you a lot about that. None of it's true. Because I was in delusion. I hadn't gotten to denial. When you get to denial, you're just a liar, which is much better than being psychotic, you know. Like, psychotic kind of really excites a therapist. You're like, yeah. He didn't do it, but he thinks he did. And so I was very fortunate, as I said, because the guys I worked with were guys who got me into the book, and they headed me off in that direction. And I started taking these steps, and what I noticed as I was taking these steps is that time was going by and I wasn't drinking. And a lot of good things began to happen. You know, I was in the process of going to jail. And I had a habit of, when I was drinking, of finding things before people officially lost them. And, you know, it was like, and there's some laws about that in New York. I don't know. And to show you how this thing started to work for me, I met a guy at a meeting. And I met my sponsor at the very first meeting I went to. You talk about lucking out. I met, my first meeting was July 5th of 1970. And I met my sponsor at that meeting, and he's still my sponsor today. You know, we've been together over 30 years, and we get a chance to really laugh at things where we both just had life just come down and mug us. But this guy was different. This other guy was a guy I kind of liked because he would dress nice and he drove a Cadillac, which at that time was a big prestige car back in the 70s. 70s were a roaring time, I mean, really, because we had a president in the White House that was under siege, you know, and gas prices were high, and Castro was running Cuba, and thank God that's all behind us. And, you know, you know. So that's why there's Bouja Day, you know, that's why there is, you know. You wake up and say, it's boy Bouja. It's a new day, but it's still that Bouja, you know. And the bottom line is that in this scenario, you know, this guy had a Cadillac, and we went to meetings. And after I took a 90-day token, about 3 months later, I was about 6 months sober, I had to go through a pretrial hearing. And I had to go see the district attorney. And I walked into this office. Now, you have to remember, this is an area of 10 million people. And I walked in, and who's the guy sitting behind the desk? The guy I went to the meetings with. And he looks up, and he says, I didn't know you did this. I said, I sure as hell didn't know you did this when we were, when we were riding around sharing, you know, like, I didn't, this is, yeah. You think you're surprised, you know, and the deal was, is that as a result of that, they called in a detective who was handling the case for the city, and it was a guy I went to high school with and played football with, and he said, if you say you did this, Ken, if you just own up to this, I'll help you. In any way I can, I'll help you. I don't want to put you in the sneezer again. So you just got to be honest. Did you do this? And, of course, at that time, I was really into rigorous honesty. I was 6 months sober, and I said, no, I didn't. You know, of course I didn't. And he said, well, I'm going to sign off the deal then because I don't want to be the guy who presses you on this. And he started for the door. And it was just like one of those things where my mouth opened and I heard myself say, whoa, wait a second. That's the way it happened. Just the way you guys have it is the way it went down. And he came back, and the three of us, the guy I went to meetings with in the Cadillac, and him, and myself, worked that thing out financially so that I would pay on it for the next 20 years into sobriety. I would make a payment every month, and I would pay that thing off. And so I had a reminder 20 years into sobriety that I had done this stuff. And the bottom line was is that something happened that night in my life that had never happened before that day. I went to a meeting that night, and what came out of that meeting was my sponsor, I told him what I had done, and he said, that's good. He said, that is the beginning. He said, the first time you tell the truth, it sounds strange. He said, but particularly in your case, but, you know, like, he said, but that's the beginning. And from that, that's like a building block, and you can build. And he says, now what we got to do is really get you down into these steps even more so that you're working them on a real regular basis. It's not a one-shot deal. And I started to do that. And what happened was my life, my wife and I and the kids were separated for 18 months. And I used to get to see my kids every other week. And I had to drive to Pennsylvania where they were living at that time. And then my wife and I decided to get back together. And things just started to happen. And the reality of this program for me is I don't need anybody to tell me that it might work. It works for me. It works for me. And I've seen it work for countless others. There's a line that we read at meetings all the time where it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I've been here over 30 years, and I've never seen anyone fail who thoroughly followed our path. I've seen people come in and do drive-by AA, you know, cameo appearance AA, you know, do all this stuff. Then it doesn't work. You know, then you're going to fall through the cracks. But if you come in and you just give yourself up to this thing, what happens is the miracle. And the miracle of AA is you get to live in the now. And you get to see what's really going on. And it doesn't matter what's gone before. It's just the fact that from this point forward, everything will go the way it's supposed to. It means reality. And I don't mean it always goes good. I'm not saying that. I'm saying is you get to live in reality. And you get to realize there's a lot going on that's fun. And you know, I look at the punishment. I mean, let's look at the facts, as somebody said. Let's look at the facts. You go through life and you screw up and you get sentenced to AA. So you get to meet nice people and go to conventions and drink coffee and do a lot of laughing and hang out with crazy people where your insanity goes totally unnoticed. And the dopey things you do, everybody thinks is funny. And that's the punishment. Wow, wow, wow. Hope I can take it. Hope I can take it, because it's tough. You know, and it's kind of like the two guys are ready to go into heaven. And St. Peter looks at the first guy, and he said, what did you do on the earth? He says, I was a taxi cab driver. He said, what's your name? So he gives him his name. He looks it up. He says, come on in. And he gives him a gold crown and a gold robe and a gold staff. The next guy comes up. He says, who are you? And he says, I was a great religious leader. So he says, let me check your name. And he gives him a cloth hat, an old wooden staff, and a gown that looked like it had been worn by two other people. And the guy says, whoa. He says, whoa, what happened here? He says, look at the way this works. He's a taxi cab driver. I'm a big religious guy. And St. Peter said, this is heaven. This is based on results. He said, when that man drove, people prayed. He said, when you spoke, people slept. You know, like, this is, you didn't really do a whole lot for us, you know. And the simplicity of this thing is, I don't know about you guys, but I think we're all in the same deal here, is that we have a deal here where we have a common bond based on a disease. This is the dopiest disease because it's an all mental disease. I know the physiological part of it and the psychological part, but it's like really mental stuff. Anytime you think that AA isn't mental, I think it was Crockett, wasn't it, tonight, who read the traditions? Go to the back and read tradition 2. In the long form, it's 22 words. In the short form, it's 32. You know? One of us said, let me help. You know, let me, I think I can work with this, you know? That's, you know, that ought to tell you right away. You know, that's the way it is. Tell me of any other disease you know. Any disease you know where the diseased person is opposed to early detection. No, not me. I'm not an alcoholic. I just drink occasionally, you know. I get arrested frequently. I just drink occasionally, you know. What kind of a disease is this? You know? And that's my best thought. In the old times, my sponsor was just the right guy for me, because when I called him up and I was whining, and whining is anger coming through a very small opening, And I used to say to him things like, my wife left me. Good for her. Good for her. God bless her. God bless her. And the kids are gone. Yeah. They're starting to catch a break already. Yeah, this is. And I'm going to jail. Yeah, that's great. That's right where you belong, And then he'd always say something that would kind of tie it together in a loving fashion. He'd say, "Hey, Ken, maybe you get lucky and die tonight." And he'd hang up. And I'd be there with the phone, and now a whole new set of, problems came in, I suppose that I die tonight, And he was that kind of a loving guy, and he had a great sense of humor. I lived with my mom when I first got sober in a senior citizen place, and I had to move out because, I'm not a senior citizen. I wasn't at that time. That was 30 years ago. And he said, "You got to go. You're getting too good with the walker," I thought this was great, you had tea and played dominoes, I was fitting right in, except I wasn't there. I had arrived prematurely, as they say, So the deal was, I moved out, and I moved into this little place where it was like my own little place, and I didn't have anything, I really just was a do-over. I was doing a do-over, and so I had orange crates, and I had a little lamp, and my wife, when she moved and took everything, left me a Hummel. And she left me this Hummel because my mom had given it to us, and she thought I should be in possession of it. So when my sponsor came in, he's a pretty big guy, and he wanted to sit down and have a cup of coffee. And in order to sit down, he was going to stabilize himself by putting a hand on the orange crate that was supporting this Hummel. And I said, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, whoa." He said, "What?" I said, "Watch out for that Hummel." He said, "What?" I said, "Watch out for that Hummel." So he picked it up, looked at it, and said, "This Hummel?" I said, "Yeah." And he threw it. And it hit the wall and just splattered all over the wall. He said, "Sit down. You don't have to worry about shit. He says, "You don't have anything. Somebody break in, they'll leave you something. I wasn't too happy initially. But he was absolutely right. When you don't have anything, there really isn't a lot of focus. Orange crates? Go down to the drugstore and get some more. I didn't need this." And so to show you now, this is a guy who has a great deal of respect for me. And I have a great deal of respect for him. And when I was 30 years sober, back in July, I get this thing from UPS, and I open it up, and I look inside, and it's a Hummel. And it's all taped together. It's the broken one. And there was a card that said, "Good things come for those who wait." And that's the deal. That's the deal for me. I have learned that nothing means no thing, no thing, no thing. And nothing is good, because out of nothing will come something. When I got here, I used to say, like many people, I lost everything. I lost everything, and I was left with nothing. And I'm here to tell you tonight, the everything I lost has turned out to be nothing. And the nothing I was left with has turned out to be everything. I got just what I needed when I needed the way I needed it. It was never any gray areas. I was the only one confused on what should have been happening. Everybody else kind of knew. It's like they say, "Yeah, we're right where you're supposed to be." Well, that's real encouraging. I want to thank you for that tremendous support and insight, And the deal is that everything is just the way it's supposed to be. Reality is reality. That's why it's called reality. Several years ago, I had a son who got very sick and he died. And I got a chance for him to be at home with me while he was going through this. And to show you how God has a great sense of humor, his mom started coming to the house. And I got to meet my husband-in-law. And, you know, and like we were a support system. This thing was working for us. And it worked well. And finally he went into hospice, and that's where he died. And right before he died, he had like some moment of clarity. When I say right before, I mean 2 or 3 days before I went into coma. And he opened his eyes and he said, "Where am I?" And I told him. And I had heard that expression, "in this world but not of this world." And when he put his head to the side of the pillow, because he shed a few tears, he was in this world. But when he came back, he was of this world. And what he said was, "I'm okay with this, Dad. I'm good to go." And he was. And 2 days later, he was gone. And he was good to go. And his mom and I were there, and we each had a hand, and we got to participate in that. And we got to go down to the little chapel there and kind of make a general amends about everything, because neither one of us wanted to leave there crippled in any way. This was tough enough, besides carrying residual baggage. And this comes as a result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have to explain things to people anymore. People say, you know, like, "Why did that happen?" Who cares? It's done. Who cares why it happened? You know, if you ask a lot of why questions, you're going to become very neurotic. You know, just skip the why questions. And the deal is, it happens because it happens. And, you know, somebody gave me a book. It was Carl Jung doing an interview with Native Americans. And it was an interesting book because in the book, he was asking these Native Americans what they thought of the Anglos. And they said, the one chief says, "They spend a lot of time seeking. They're always seeking. We don't know what they're seeking. They're seeking this. They're seeking. We think they're mad." You know? And we are, because we're looking for what we already have. We're running around using up a lot of time that we could be doing something else, just, you know, looking. We're looking and looking, and we already got it. And you got to just learn to be who you are here. You know, like if you wake up in the morning and you're a rose and you want to be a daffodil, it's a long day. It's a long, long day, you know. And at the end of it, no matter what you do, you're going to go to bed a rose, you know. And everything has a season. It comes and it goes, you know. It just has a season. And there's a lot of books that talk about that. The Alcoholics Anonymous book, where it says deep down inside each one of us is the fundamental idea. Do you know you can't find a spiritual writing that says anything different than that? You can read the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, the Quran, the Bible. I don't care what you read. They're all saying the same thing. There must be some truth to it. It's not out here, it's in here. We were sent out from the home office, okay. And somewhere along the way, we decided that wasn't enough, so we made up another person. And that person just doesn't work, you know, because it's not who we are. And we're seeking. And I sometimes think we are mad, you know. And the bottom line is that you get to a point here where you just say, you know what, this is a good deal. Being an alcoholic is a good deal. You get to do all the things you never thought you wanted to do, you know. And then you find out that's just exactly what I want to do, you know. I was sharing with somebody, I was dating a gal from Mississippi, and we went to New Orleans, and we were in this room, and her sister lived in Gulfport, so she called her sister to come over. So she took the room next to ours. And that night it was raining, so we didn't go down into the French Quarter because it was raining real hard. And so her sister came in the room, and the two of the sisters got into bed. And we didn't go out, so we were eating like Snickers bars and, you know, and Diet Pepsi. And there was I can't believe this night. It was like a Ronald Reagan movie. And I said, "Gosh, you know," I said, "this is amazing." And she said, "Why?" I said, "I'm in the sin city of the world with two sisters in bed, and I'm eating a Snickers bar and drinking a Diet Pepsi and excited about watching Ronald Reagan movies. You know, like, you know, AA has really done a lot for me. You know, like, you know, this is exciting stuff." And it was exciting, you know, it was exciting. And the bottom line is that that's happened to me over and over and over again, you know. And I can just tell you from where I'm at, you know, there's a little mystic prayer that I've gotten hooked on, and it says, you know, you cannot catch hold of it, nor can you let go of it. In not being able to get it, you get it. When you are speaking, it's silent. When you are silent, it speaks. And for me, that has been a very important part of my life over the last few years, learning to be silent. I go on these little silent retreats. I started out with a couple of days and worked my way up to a month. And the bottom line is that I need to be in conscious contact many times, many, many, many times a day with that deal. And I don't want to let it slip away. And it's very, very critical that I do stay in touch with that. And I want to thank you folks for inviting me to come here. This has been a great fellowship weekend for me so far. I enjoyed Charles last night, and I'm looking forward to the rest of the speakers, some of whom I've known in the past, have met. And it's just going to be a good weekend. But it's going to be starting with a good Friday night, a good right now. And you know, when you take now and spell it backwards, it's one, W-O-N. When you learn to live in the now, you won. And when you look at the word spiritual, you'll see the word ritual inside the word spiritual. And we learn to do the ritual here. We know how to do this. There's four steps to any spiritual path. And that is, you know, you show up, pay attention, tell the truth, and don't be attached to the results. And we got that down in AA. All the stuff that people have been talking about for years, these bozos found and put it in AA. I don't know how they did it. I mean, can you imagine the likes of them, you know, doing this? And then you look at the two co-founders, you know, to show you the paradox of this program. Bill had a hot flash in Towns Hospital, and, you know, he was okay. Bob, for the first 7 years, he was sober, wanted to drink every day. He had this insatiable drive to drink. And these two guys connected. And you realize, my God, the way they connected. It's an amazing, amazing thing. So I want to thank you for letting me come here. And I want to remind you that we're really on loan to one another. We're not here that much, and we're really on loan to one another. And we got to take really good care of one another. Because if we don't, who will? And I want to thank you for letting me be here. God bless you. Namaste.